Khomeini and the June 1963 riot. The White Revolution, and in particular the land reforms and women's greater visibility in public life, were bound to raise grave concerns among conservative sectors of Iranian society. The land reform had already triggered a revolt among tribal khans and large landowners who were discontent with the prospects of losing their easily earned livelihood. As for the clergy, as early as the 1950s, some tensions were detectable between the Pahlavi state and the Ghom establishment. Yet, despite the differences, there existed a guarded rapport. The Shi'i upper ranks viewed the Shah as an imperfect but viable partner, and in the course of the 1953 coup, most of the upper and middle ranks, Khomeini included, had sided with Kashani and Barujerdi in their tacit support for the Shah, being fearful of the Tudeh takeover. With the introduction of the Shah's reform program, however, that view began to change. The up-and-coming clerics with radical views and their students in Ghom clearly were disgruntled with the Pahlavi state on ideological as well as material grounds. As early as September 1962, signs of public discontent were visible to foreign observers. A US intelligence report warned, "The growing political unrest of the urban middle class was being manifested increasingly openly, and we estimated that profound political and social change was virtually inevitable. We added that such change would most likely be revolutionary in nature." In reasserting his own exclusive dominance, the Shah has acted in accordance with his long-standing belief that Iran is far from ready for a true parliamentary government, and that the country can be ruled effectively only by a strong man like himself who understands Iran's problems. He will be reluctant to share power with anyone, and will not consent to any such permanent impairment of his authority as would be implied in a meaningful compromise with the Nationalists, a reference to the Second National Front. His preoccupation with military matters and his relative indifference to administrative and fiscal improvement will almost certainly persist. Under these circumstances, Iran's political structure will continue to be extremely fragile. Over the longer term, profound political and social change appears virtually inevitable. Though not yet clear to American observers, militancy within the clerical community greatly accelerated this state of influx. Barujerdi's death in March 1961 triggered a leadership contest that brought to the surface tensions between the moderate camp and the radicals, forever transforming clerical politics. As the most prominent representative of the radical leaning, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, 1902-1989, seriously clashed with the Pahlavi state, not only over the course of the reforms, but also on issues of foreign policy. By 1963, he mobilized against the Shah a sizable sector of the population, mostly associated with the bazaar and the urban lower middle classes, a rehearsal, perhaps, for the Islamic Revolution that would flare up 17 years later. Khomeini's life and thoughts may offer clues to this fundamental shift toward militancy and to the challenges the Shi'i clergy faced throughout the early part of the 20th century. He was born to a provincial landowning clerical family in Khomein, a small agricultural town in the well-watered valleys of the Iraq-e-Ajam region of central Iran, 220 miles south of Tehran and halfway between Isfahan and the emerging clerical center of Ghom. His extended family of middle-sized landowners led a relatively affluent life in a climate of violence and insecurity that characterized the early life of Ruhollah, the youngest of six children. Clashes among feudal landlords and local bandits were one sign of the breakdown of the Qajar order in the years just after the Constitutional Revolution. His father, a third-generation Shi'i cleric who migrated first from Kashmir in northern India to Najaf, settled in Khomein in the 1840s. He himself was victim of violent local skirmishes when, acting as a public advocate for the local merchants and landlords, he was gunned down by rival gangs. The young Ruhollah, Ru'Allah, means the Spirit of God, a Quranic title for Jesus, and a relatively rare first name for the children of Shi'i clergy, was brought up by his mother, and after his mother's premature death, by his paternal aunt, a woman of strong character who left her footprint on the young boy. He received a typical elementary maktab education in Khomein, from female and male instructors, including his older brother, but not modern schooling. In the years following the Constitutional Revolution, Khomein, like most small towns, was untouched by modern education, even though the young Ruhollah may have learned rudiments of arithmetic, calligraphy, and some Persian poetry. In his early years, Ruhollah witnessed armed bandits harassing the local population and warlords feuding among themselves, an occurrence so common that even his own family house, built as a small fortress, had to be defended against frequent sorties. At times, members of his household were engaged in shootouts from the ramparts. At other times, the family rented out the humble but strategic tower to rival bands. The family defended itself with guns, available in greater abundance in the aftermath of the Constitutional Revolution, at a time when the lines between banditry and self-defense were blurred. In 1918, at the end of World War I, cholera visited the region, killing Ruhollah's mother. This loss may have weakened the boy's ties with his hometown. 2 years later, as a young seminarian, he moved to the town of Arak, old Sultanabad, then a bustling mercantile center with vast agricultural estates, an important carpet industry, and an active madrasa network. He studied under, among others, Abdul Karim Ha'eri, the reputed jurisprudence teacher and marja who served as his mentor. A year later, in 1921, he followed Ha'eri to Gom, a pilgrimage town that would soon transform itself under Ha'eri, and later Borujerdi, into the foremost teaching center, Hozeh, in Iran. Perhaps faintly inspired by the idea of the university, the Hozeh consisted of a number of madrasas and smaller teaching circles affiliated in an informal network. It offered a somewhat systematic approach to Shi'i education and clerical training. The move to Gom coincided with the ascendancy of Reza Khan, whose rise to power and secularizing program left an indelible impression on the young Khomeini and his worldview. His deep hostility toward Reza Khan, as Khomeini invariably referred to the Pahlavi ruler, was at the core of his opposition to the new regime. Yet, ironically, in 1924 in Gom, he must have witnessed his admired teacher and mentor orchestrating a grand reconciliation between the Shi'i Marjas, some more senior than Ha'eri himself, and Reza Khan. In Gom, while following his education in Islamic law, a discipline quickly losing all its societal relevance in Pahlavi Iran, Khomeini did not shy away from speculative mysticism, Irfan, and Islamic philosophy. Such fields, even when innocuously termed hechmat, wisdom, gnosis, rather than philosophy, falsafe, continued to be denounced by the insular jurists of Gom as heretical, dangerous, and essentially antithetical to the teachings of Islam. Yet, contrary to Najaf, the study of Irfan and Hechmat, with a strong Neoplatonic bent, was not entirely absent in Gom teaching circles. His teacher of mysticism, Muhammad Ali Shahabadi, 1872-1949, seems to have played an important role in Khomeini's mystical and philosophical orientation and understanding of Islam, not simply as mundane teachings of fiqh, but as deeper moral values and self-discovery for personal and social improvement. A blend of Shi'i jurisprudence, speculative mysticism, as opposed to mysticism of the Sufis and the Sufi orders, and Islamic ethical and revivalist awareness thus characterized Khomeini's training. Yet, despite his interest in speculative mysticism, he remained loyal to the jurist tradition that carried a certain element of clerical entitlement, especially among high-ranking mujtahids. He not only inherited this conservative, pedantic, text-oriented legacy, but also shared a sense of communal loyalty to fellow jurists that was reinforced by isolation under the Pahlavi rule. Sensitivity toward the wishes of their constituency, the Moghaleds, a perpetually frowning and aloof demeanor, and a display of apparent independence from sources of temporal power were his other hallmarks. He was heir to a closely knit madrasa environment with a strong patron-client relationship between teachers and students, as well as a culture of austerity among students, honed by years of communal living, often in a state of abject poverty. Crucial though legal training and madrasa culture were for Khomeini, they did not seem to satisfy his questioning mind. He remained troubled by the predicaments of his time and what he considered the fading of Islam as society's moral standard. In practice, these boiled down to such anxieties as to how to avoid the mandatory dress codes under Reza Shah that forced many of his cohorts, and even members of his family, to don Western suits and wear the rimmed Pahlavi hat. The very resistance to state-enforced conformity helped fashion a new ethos of dissent. Typical of many Muslim reformists of clerical origin, who were wary of studying jurisprudence in the madrasa curriculum, Khomeini searched in speculative mysticism for a deeper understanding of Islam's message and its relevance to his time. The study of philosophy, mostly Avicenna's selective reworking of the Greek masters, had never been abandoned in Shi'i learning. Mainly through the 17th century school of Isfahan and by taking on the eclectic approach of Malla Sadra, the Shi'i students of philosophy were able to engage even the mystical discourse of such defining figures as the 12th century Andalusian mystic Ibn al-Arabi. Most conservative jurists, though, denounced Ibn al-Arabi and even Malla Sadra as heretics and condemned the study of their works as unconscionable. Such speculative preoccupations brought Khomeini in the 1940s and early 1950s to the limits of madrasa tolerance. Fearing charges of heresy and even denunciation by the Qom jurists, he was persuaded to abandon the teaching of philosophy, at least in public, and return to the jurists' fold. He even produced a practical treatise, Resaliyya Amaliyya, on the intricate points of Shi'i rituals and civil law, mostly based on the fatwas he had issued over the years on such issues as ablution and ritual pollutants, nullifiers of prayer and fasting, perverted sexual behavior, and relations with non-believers. Adopting the guise of a conventional mujtahid and publishing his resali helped qualify Khomeini as a grand ayatollah. His political activism, which soon erupted in open defiance of the Pahlavi state, would not have had the desired effect had it not been for his recognition as one of the four highest-ranking jurists in Iran to emerge after Borujerdi. Yet what turned him into a revolutionary prophet, anxious to save the wronged Islam from threats of a secular world, came essentially from his mystico-philosophical bent. Ibn al-Arabi's claim to be the seal of the saints, Khatam al-Awliya, may well have contributed to Khomeini's later articulation of the doctrine of the authority of the jurist, Welayat-e Faqih. In effect, by returning to the jurist's fold, Khomeini reinvented jurisprudence. No longer was it a mere obsession with pollution and intricate points of ritual cleansing, the rudiments of Shi'i jurisprudence. Rather, it aimed at cleansing the polluting politics and morals of secular modernity. Khomeini's engagement with the sufferings of the Shi'i imams and their agonies, a sacred narrative of endurance to Shi'is of all backgrounds, formed the third dimension in his multi-layered outlook. In his mind, the Shi'i friends, essentially followers of the clerical establishment, were differentiated from the Pahlavi foes and their heathen allies, in the same cosmic scheme that separated the friends of Hossein ibn Ali in Karbala from his foes. This was a universe inhabited by many saints of the past and many demons of the present. In this universe of anger and defiance, his communal brethren, mostly the clergy and their lay followers, constituted the self, while the alien other, the secularizing state and its domestic and foreign allies, were to be kept at a safe distance. In Khomeini's worldview, if this alien other and its intrusive pollutants were not defied and denounced in their entirety, they were bound to destroy the very essence of pristine but vulnerable Islam. Through an act of remembrance, Rose Khwani, the narrative of martyrdom in Shi'i sacred history, recited in a melodramatic tone from the pulpit of the mosques, was a powerful means of mass mobilization. Khomeini was fully aware of its power and skillful in employing it at crucial moments. The Muharram ceremonies, mourning processions, weeping, and self-flagellation became conduits for connecting with the popular culture of ordinary believers. In this respect, Khomeini utilized features of Shi'i culture complete with intonation, figures of speech, and a firm loyalty to the popular myths of rituals of suffering and martyrdom. His small-town upbringing, and later his stay in Najaf, were not entirely alien to the world outside the Shi'i madrasa, or the pulpit of the mosque, or the Muharram ceremonies. Though before 1979 he never lived in a large city, in his own terms he absorbed selected elements of modernity in defiance of state-sponsored secularism. As early as 1944, in an open letter, he called on Iranians to rise up against the injustices that the despicable Reza Khan imposed on them, and he held advocates of Pahlavi secularism responsible for degrading the clergy, removing the veil from chaste women, having a corrupting influence on the press, and sending bogus deputies to the majlis. The absence of communal solidarity, he lamented, was what brought defenceless Islam to an abyss into which it had now fallen, making it an easy target for the onslaught of heathen modernists and enemies of Islam. In a prophetic tone, he went on to caution, "It is because of sheer selfishness and neglect to stage an uprising for the sake of God that we are doomed to such a dark fate that the whole world has prevailed over us and the Islamic nations were brought under the domination of alien others. It is the selfish interests that has suffocated the spirit of unity and brotherhood within the Islamic nation. Oh, the spiritual leaders of Islam, you, the ulama of God, today is the day that the breeze of divine spirituality is blowing on us, and it is the best of times to start a reformative uprising. If you miss this opportunity and don't rise up in the path of God and don't restore religious rights, tomorrow yet another lustful, licentious bunch will prevail over you and make all your faith and honour subject to their false malevolence. Today, what excuse do you have before God the Creator?" Remarkably, he then went on to contrast the lack of solidarity among Muslims to the Baha'i sense of camaraderie. Even if in a small village a slightest affront would have directed toward Baha'i religion, all co-religionists would have risen in one spirit and with a single objective. In this declaration, as in other writings, Khomeini also responded in the post-war era to critics of clerical Shi'ism, including Ahmad Khazravi, the well-known journalist and scholar who, in the 1930s and 1940s, initiated a modernist religious movement of Unitarian character, free of what he called superstitions and fallacies. In his influential essays, and later in his 1944 pamphlet titled Shi'e-Gari, Shi'ism, Khazravi depicted Shi'i Islam as nothing more than a jumble of myths, rituals, and fables manufactured by demagogic mullahs and designed to preserve their vested interests and control over the ignorant masses. Khazravi's prophet-like call for a moral revival and his campaign against the Shi'i clerical establishment, as well as against the Sufis, the Baha'i, and the cultural establishment of the Pahlavi era, brought him few devotees and many sworn enemies. In his Kashf-e-Asrar, Unveiling Mysteries, Khomeini systematically tried to retract such charges brought by, among others, Khazravi. In his judgment, attacks on Shi'i beliefs and rituals were comparable to the attacks the Wahhabi savages of Arabia had long levelled against Shi'ism. Holding nothing back, he was among the first to call upon believers to physically eliminate Khazravi for his blasphemy. It was not mere coincidence that members of Fadayan-e-Islam assassinated Khazravi in March 1945, shortly after the publication of Khomeini's book. Critics of Shi'ism aside, the defiance in Khomeini's early writings was also directed at the Shi'i clerical establishment, which he viewed as timid and compromising. The modern intelligentsia, too, he depicts as disloyal to Islam and captivated by the West. The Muslim people, in Iran and elsewhere, were also portrayed as victims of tyranny at home, foreign powers, and a general lack of awareness of Islam. The decadence and decrepitude he sensed in Islam's waning power was typical of most Islamic activists, at least since the middle of the 19th century. Yet what set Khomeini apart from other resentful Islamic advocates was his loyalty to the conservative Islam of the jurists and the clerical establishment, whom he wished, even in the early years of his activism, would become natural leaders of the community at the forefront of the war against satanic forces that threatened Muslim integrity. Confronting the Shah. The opening of the political climate under Amini made Khomeini's anti-Pahlavi presence more pronounced on the political stage. This was something of a shift in his position, for it was not a secret that Khomeini disliked Mossadegh for not complying with Islamic principles. He even criticized Kashani for presumed abandoning the Fadayane Islam in favor of Mossadegh. In the late 1940s, he had met with the Shah a number of times as Barujerdi's emissary, expressing concern over the threat of the Tude and the role the Fadayan would play as a counterweight to the left. In the late 1950s, however, Khomeini's relationship with Barujerdi turned sour, not only over control of the Gom Hoze, but also because of Barujerdi's occasional compliance with the government's wishes. Khomeini generally disapproved of the non-political Mojtaheds for their compromising stance toward the state and reluctance to speak out unanimously. His criticism was reciprocated by the politically conservative clergy. They distrusted Khomeini all the more because of his popularity among the younger generation of seminarians who were attracted to his teaching circle. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, Khomeini began to question a number of issues of domestic and foreign policy. Starting with marginal issues, such as the mingling of Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and the performing of dances, he soon moved on to more substantive concerns, such as the passing of the first land reform legislation in 1959 and the opening of informal diplomatic relations with Israel and economic collaboration with the Jewish state. In 1962, when the government tried to introduce the elected provincial councils sanctioned by the 1906 to 1907 constitution, mostly the Shah's window dressing to compensate for closing other political channels, Khomeini was at the forefront of clerical opposition, objecting even to the hint of women's right to vote. He argued that the voting regulations failed to specify the male gender and hence exclude women from the electorate. Along with other Ayatollahs in Qom, he also objected to dropping the oath of allegiance to the Quran for the provincial council's delegates, an omission seen in Qom as a concession to the Baha'is and their election to the councils rather than as a symbolic delinking of religion and politics. In his telegram to the Premier, Asadullah Alam, in October 1962, Khomeini further threatened that on these and other issues contrary to Sharia, he would not remain silent and that, in response, the government would face severe clerical opposition. Under pressure, the Alam government caved, abandoning, at least temporarily, the idea of provincial councils. This only helped bolster Khomeini's opposition to issues ranging from the 6 points of the White Revolution to the regime's corruption and mismanagement, its subservience to the United States, and its friendly relations with Israel. Now elevated to the lead opposition figure, at the expense of the Second National Front and other secular voices, Khomeini went as far as boycotting the proposed referendum of February 1963. His grounds for objection, predictably, were women's right to vote and the illegitimacy under Islamic law of the land reforms and other reform measures. His radical stance gained some support in Qom, which went through unrest and bloody clashes with security forces. Beyond Qom, a sector of the landowning classes, as well as some bazaar merchants, both large and petty, was unhappy with the economy growing outside their reach, and so backed Khomeini. In the following months, a showdown between Khomeini's supporters and the security forces seemed inevitable. A serious tribal uprising in Fars province among the Kashgai and other affiliated tribes against the land reform program persuaded the Shah to assume that there was a grand alliance between Khomeini and his supporters, the tribal Khans, and their allies. Even though the Shah had tried to work out, with the Qom establishment, a peaceful understanding of their differences, he was anxious not to convey an image of weakness when his entire political enterprise was at stake. The demonstrations in Qom against the regime and in support of Khomeini soon triggered a violent reaction from the government. An unprovoked attack by the security forces on the prayer congregation in the Faiziye Mosque and Madrasa, the core of Qom activism, in March 1963, resulted in multiple deaths and injuries, as well as property damage. the 40th Memorial, Arba'in, of the Fayziyeh crackdown in early June 1963, coincided with Muharram observances, always a time of great emotional upsurge. In his speech on the 10th of Muharram, the Ashura, the most sacred day in the Shi'i calendar, Khomeini, on the pulpit of Fayziyeh and before thousands of Muharram mourners, openly condemned the government in a highly emotional tone. Comparing the Fayziyeh incident in March to the wrongs inflicted by the Umayyads on the third Shi'i imam, he held the Shah responsible for the atrocities and further denounced Israel and its presumed domestic collaborators for aiming to destroy the very foundations of Islam. The emphasis on Israel was particularly effective. He accused the Shah of selling out Iran to the Israelis, who, he claimed, intended to destroy Iran's agriculture and take over its economy. He denounced the Shah's referendum on the White Revolution as a fraud and accused the Pahlavi state of corruption, misappropriation of public funds, and accumulation of illegitimate wealth. He contrasted these excesses of the regime with the frugal and selfless clergy of Qom. He advised the Shah, as he put it, in the strongest terms to abandon Israel, to listen to the Marjas, and do not deviate from the path of Islam so as to avoid the sad fate of his father, whose abdication brought joy to Iranian hearts. Touching upon such sensitive themes in an emotionally charged environment, Khomeini's speech was repeatedly interrupted by the loud weeping of the mournful audience. For the first time, a copy of the recorded tape of his speech soon travelled across Iran and resonated with the people in the bazaars and streets of the poorer neighbourhoods. The powerful call for defiance quickly bore results, leading to a bloody uprising in the capital and some provincial cities. In the early hours of June the 5th, 2 days after his Fayziyeh speech, Khomeini was arrested by security forces and brought to Tehran, detained in the officers' club, where Mossadegh had been detained, before being sent off to jail. On the same day, June the 5th, as the news of Khomeini's arrest reached the public, Iranian cities witnessed a violent uprising. As if the crowd had anticipated the arrest, tens of thousands of protesters holding makeshift placards of Khomeini's portrait and shouting slogans against the Shah poured into the streets near the bazaar and other neighbourhoods of Tehran, smashing shop windows, burning down banks and cinemas, and attacking bus stations, police stations, and government buildings. Among other places, the Pepsi bottling facility, the Iran-US Cultural Centre, and Iranian broadcasting services were attacked and burned down. The crowd, aroused by devout supporters of Khomeini from among the gang leaders, lutis, of Tehran's wholesale vegetable market, armed with sticks and knives, began to move in the direction of the Marmar Royal Palace in central Tehran, where the Shah's office was located. Facing a mass rebellion destabilizing the Shah's regime, the security forces moved in with trucks, tanks, heavy machine guns, and thousands of troops. Declaring martial law, the Tehran military command began a systematic clampdown in the center and on the edges of the capital. Surrounding the main entrance to the Tehran Bazaar with a half-circle of menacing M-35 REO troop carriers, M-103 heavy tanks and fire engines, all with their headlights on, the troops first aimed high-pressure water cannons at the crowd trapped at the bazaar entrance. Shortly afterward, machine guns began to shoot, first intermittently and then indiscriminately. Once the first round of the assault downed protesters at the entrance, squads of riot police moved into the bazaar's main thoroughfare, pummeling the fleeing crowd with their batons. At least 125 people were killed, though some estimates put the figure as high as 400, and many more were injured in 2 days of bloody confrontations in the capital and provincial centres. Hundreds more were detained before relative calm could be returned to the cities. Bodies of victims, it was rumoured, were buried in unmarked mass graves outside the capital, and those who had fallen in Qom were dumped in the salty swamp deep into the Qom desert. In Fars province, a simultaneous uprising among the Boyer Ahmad Lur tribes was put down, and the Gashgai and other tribes of the region were contained and disarmed. Since the start of land reforms, a series of revolts had been pacified, marking perhaps the last of the tribal unrest Iran was to witness over the nearly 250 years since the fall of the Safavids. With the end of what came to be labelled the Fars Uprising, never again did the Iranian tribes, or what was left of their nomadic lifestyle, play a significant role in shaping Iran's political history. Chiefs of the Kashgai and other affiliated tribes, deprived of their tribal titles, were detained and sent into internal exile. A few charged with armed rebellion were also sent before the firing squad. The government declared the tribe itself as officially terminated, and by then they had mostly settled in and around Firuzabad, 70 miles south of Shiraz. Khomeini was held in an army barracks in Tehran for nearly 2 months, before being put under house arrest for another 8 months. A handful of mujtahids in major cities, many Khomeini's supporters and students, were temporarily detained. The gang leaders responsible for the Tehran uprising were tried and hanged, and all physical signs of destruction in Tehran were quickly removed or restored. Yet the psychological wounds inflicted by the revolt remained unhealed. Khomeini, seemingly unrepentant and untarnished, returned to Qom in March 1964. He was spared the death sentence and released from detention after the other marjas in Qom, including Ayatollah Shariat Madari, pleaded with the Shah, cautioning him of the dire consequences of executing a major figure like Khomeini. There was no love lost between Khomeini and the other Ayatollahs in Qom. What was at stake, however, was clerical prestige, and their glaring display of ineffectiveness before the state were one of their cohort to be detained or eliminated, an unprecedented event, save for the 1909 revolutionary trial and execution of Sheikh Fazlollah Nuri. In March 1964, the coming to office of a more appeasing government under Hassan Ali Mansour, 1923-1965, was instrumental in Khomeini's release. His appointment generated further hope for reconciliation. Khomeini, relying on his growing popular support in and out of the bazaar, was determined to carry on his crusade even if, as he stated, it were to cost him his life. As if retreating from the Fadayan-e-Islam agenda of the 1950s, whose supporters no doubt were crucial in the June uprising, Qom, under the spell of Khomeini, demanded implementation of Islamic laws and abolition of the White Revolution's anti-Islamic decrees, which in reality meant reversing the land reform program and especially returning Waqf properties to their trustees. Honoring the demands of the Shi'i clergy also meant annulling women's right to vote, the possible enforcement of hijab, and allowance of tahziyyah and other mourning ceremonies that the regime had deemed superstitious and barbaric. In a speech in Qom a few days after Khomeini's arrival, he also called for dissolution of the Majlis and the Senate, accused the Pahlavi state of being in cahoots with Israel and the agents of Zionism, and called for an end to corruption. More vociferously than on earlier occasions, he also accused the Baha'is of perceived charges of occupying positions of power and collaborating with Israel. Most important, the declaration called for the implementation of Article 2 of the 1907 Supplement to the Iranian Constitution, which stipulated the creation of a 5-member mujtahid body to oversee the legislation of the Majlis. The Pahlavi state and its projected reform program could not remotely honour any such demands. 6 months later, Khomeini found a new occasion to renew his vitriolic attack on the Shah and the Mansour government, this time objecting to the judicial immunity granted to American military personnel and their dependents, who served as advisers to the Iranian armed forces. In a speech delivered in October 26, 1964, he attacked the concession as a renewal of the hated capitulatory most favoured nations rights of the Qajar era. His criticism stemmed from a clause in the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, to which Iran had become a signatory, whereby the host country had the option of relinquishing jurisdiction over foreign diplomats and their associates by granting them immunity from prosecution in the host country. Passed after some heated debate in the Majlis, the issue was quickly picked up by opposition circles. Ayatollah Khomeini, now fully recognized as a marja and decidedly tilting the clerical balance toward political opposition, made the most of the state's new diplomatic concession. In a passionate speech delivered in Fezziyeh before a huge crowd, coinciding with the lavish celebration of the Shah's birthday on October 26th, Khomeini skillfully played on the bitter memories of the 19th century capitulatory rights first granted to Russia in 1828 and then to other countries. In light of Reza Shah's 1927 abolition of the capitulation, hailed at the time as a major Pahlavi victory in reclaiming Iran's judicial sovereignty, the concession extended to the U.S. advisory mission seemed exceptionally bold, even foolhardy. From the Iranian perspective, as voiced by Khomeini, this was yet another sign of Pahlavi's subservience to the superpower and a slap in the face of Iran's Islamic pride. The clause was included in the treaty at the request of the United States to allow for the ratification of a long-negotiated loan of $200 million to build up the Iranian military. A stronger military was a point of confluence between the U.S. Cold War strategic concerns and the Shah's insatiable appetite for the latest military hardware. Within the higher echelons of the U.S. government, moreover, there existed a sense of moral entitlement that disbursing such a hefty loan and the advisory military expertise that would accompany it could not be done without firm immunity for the U.S. personnel in a country like Iran, which, by the Americans' judgment, was facing religious discord and anti-American sentiments. To Khomeini, and to the majority of the Iranians, this was nothing short of neo-colonial indenture. If a servant or a cook of an American citizen kills or pummels under his feet your marja-e-taqlid in the middle of the bazaar, Khomeini contended, the Iranian police cannot arrest him. The Iranian courts would have no jurisdiction. His file is to be forwarded to the United States so as to be adjudicated by the masters there. In a mix of hyperbole and combativeness, heightened after his release from detention, Khomeini then leveled a litany of charges against the Shah and his government, including selling off Iran's sovereignty, being subservient to the Americans, facilitating Israel's economic influence, pandering to the Americans for a huge loan with a scandalously high interest rate, convening a fraudulent majlis, guarding animosity toward religious authorities, attempting in vain to create divisions among the Ayatollahs, causing the decline of agriculture, and forwarding the White Revolution as a mere propaganda scheme. He further condemned the mingling of boys and girls, especially in mixed schools, attacked as distorted the history textbooks portraying the clergy as detrimental to the prosperity of the country, and above all, called on the clergy, the armed forces, statesmen, and the businessmen of Iran to beware of the impending decline and loss of Islam, calling on the Najaf Shi'i Ayatollahs and heads of Islamic nations, including the Shah. He warned, "Since we are a weak nation and don't have dollars, does it mean that we should be pummeled under the American boots? America is worse than Britain, and Britain is worse than America, and the Soviet Union is worse than both of them. Each is worse than the other and much more evil than the other. Yet today we are faced with America." The focus of this vitriolic attack was the U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson, whom Khomeini believed to be the most spiteful toward our nation than any human being because of the wrongs he inflicted on the Islamic nation. The Quran is his enemy. The people of Iran are his enemy. The government of the United States should know that in Iran he has been debased and scandalized. This fuming rhetoric left little room for compromise. A week later, coinciding with the ratification in the Majlis of the American loan, the Iranian special forces surrounded Khomeini's house in Qom. He was whisked out of the city directly to Tehran airport and put on an airplane that took him to Turkey, where he spent a year in exile in the city of Bursa, known for its Islamic loyalties. Accompanied by his son, Mustafa, and clad in civilian clothing, he visited mosques and shrines in the ancient city. Later on, moving to Najaf, he kept a distance from the city's clerical politics, although he was by no means isolated. He remained in exile for the following 13 years, writing and teaching, but also preserving his network of supporters and followers throughout Iran. Through his devout students and bizarre contacts, he collected religious dues and redistributed funds among his former and current students and for other religious causes. With Khomeini's departure, the four-year-old campaign of the Islamic militants lost momentum, even though it did not come to a halt before taking the life of Hassan Ali Mansour, who, ironically, aimed to mend fences with Khomeini. In January 1965, 10 weeks into Khomeini's exile, the Fadayan-e-Islam assassins gunned down the premier in front of the majlis. The assassins almost all were veterans of the Fadayan cadre, with connections to Khomeini's circle. Inspired by his diatribe, the assassins viewed Mansour as a pro-American agent. They no doubt were active in organizing the June 1963 protests to recruit a private army that included lutis and lower ranks of the bazaar. With the effective removal of the liberal and nationalist opinion of the Mossadegh era, the Pahlavi royal autocracy and the Ghom clerical militancy stood face to face, each prescribing a very different vision of the future. Both adhered to the nationalist narrative, but commonality ended there. The Pahlavi grip on power, implementing a reformist agenda from above, enabled an alliance with the West, adherence to a modernizing program, and an oil-dependent economy. It relied on loyal statesmen and apolitical technocrats, often children of the earlier generation of military, landed bureaucratic classes and the educated middle classes. Even if they were from religiously observant families or the old elite, they received a secular education and often had some experience in the West. Their demeanor, lifestyle, and outlook, at least in public, were largely in tune with the Pahlavi project. Like the Shah, they aspired to a secular Iran modeled on the West and relying, at times slavishly, on Western expertise, know-how, and advice. Yet the milieu in which the Pahlavi elite used to operate often nurtured a degree of cynicism and hypocrisy injurious to the very loyalties on which the Pahlavi order was first erected. The world of Ghom in the post-Reza Shah era, in contrast, turned more insular, radical, and anti-Western. As the Pahlavi state recruited from among the turbaned classes and turned them into stiff, tie and fedora-wearing civil servants, a new class of seminarians from among the peasants, small landowners, and urban lower classes gradually replaced them. They built a new clerical community, predominantly hostile to the Pahlavi approach. Inspired by radical trends beyond Iran, from Salafi Islam of the Arab world to the leftist propaganda of Radio Cairo and Radio Moscow, many among this generation of the clergy developed a new perspective loyal to conventional readings of the Sharia, parochial in its worldview and radical in its politics. They were against women's presence in public life, co-education and mixing of genders, such leisurely expressions such as cinema, music, tourism, and fashion, and sexual liberties and homosexuality. As much as they were hostile to these foreign trends, they were also at war with the indigenous voices critical of clerical insularity from the Baha'i and the Sufi to various intellectual critics such as Khasravi and his message of moral reform. After the June 1963 uprising, the Khomeini brand of clerical radicalism retreated but was not defeated. Returning to the madrasa, they began to solidify their ground over the following decade and would re-emerge 15 years later, better equipped and with access to a larger audience. New poetry and new anxieties. Even if the Pahlavi state momentarily basked in its successful crushing of Islamic activism and implementation of its own vision of reform, the intellectual critiques of the state, especially after 1953, revealed a sharply different perspective. Most Iranian writers, poets, and social critics of the post-war era, impressed with the discourse of the left, often through the Tudeh party, moved away from the Persian classical norms and modes of expression, which they shunned as arcane and elitist. They gravitated instead toward new literary forms, prose and poetry, and new schools of thought, mostly products of the 20th century Western European milieu. They found such media more effective in portraying the plight of the ordinary people, which they considered their social mission. Realism, with a Marxist overtone, and existentialist engagé literature of the period were appealing to a small but influential clique of Iranian intellectuals who engaged in these trends so as to express the anxieties of their time and portray their political disillusionment, moral predicaments, and sense of alienation. A quest for authenticity, a predictable reaction to the positivist modernity of the Pahlavi state, further shaped Iranian cultural production between the 1940s and 1960s, questioning the wholesale acceptance of Western values and their hegemony over non-Western societies, which came to be known in the intellectual vernacular of the time as garbzadegi, meaning struck by the West, Westoxication, or plague of the West. To debate over the evils of Westernizing gradually shifted the intellectual horizons from a typical wariness toward anything Islamic, calling it superstitious, to an idealized interpretation of Islam as remedy against Westernism and a means of resisting the Pahlavi regime. After 1953, both the discourse of alienation and the quest for cultural authenticity gradually transformed the Marxist-Stalinist orientation of the post-war era and moved it in new directions. Ahead of themselves, many of the literary voices could see only prolonged gloom, a dawnless night, which became a recurring image in the literature of the period. The ancillary to this was an almost messianic hope for a saviour of sorts who would end the status quo, more by revolution than by political process. No matter how secular, these intellectuals did not seem to have liberated themselves from the legacy of Iranian messianism, both in motif and in aspiration, or the cult of revering the failed hero. Their secular, often leftist, frame of reference could hardly conceive of a revolution of the shape and magnitude that would occur less than two decades later. They could hardly foresee a prophetic figure like Khomeini, even though the June 1963 uprising seemed like a rehearsal for what was in the offing. An early critic of the moral universe of Shi'i Islam and European cultural intrusion was the aforementioned Ahmad Khasravi, 1890-1946. His vision was an uneasy marriage of nationalism and prophetic inspiration. A former seminarian from Tabriz, who witnessed the last phase of the constitutional revolution in his hometown and was shaped by that experience, Khasravi, in his secular attire, represented a brand of nationalist positivism of the early Pahlavi era. His History of the Constitutional Revolution, a widely read narrative, defined the revolution as a national liberation movement pioneered by the enlightened mujtahids and brought to fruition by ordinary folks. Khasravi also employed pure language, Zaban-e Pak, devoid of Arabic and other foreign words, to narrate his story. More than his historical work or his use of pure Persian, however, as a social critic, his iconoclastic attack on the masters of Persian classical poetry gained Khasravi notoriety. His portrayal of classical poetry as decadent and morally corrupting, for it promoted homosexual love and a hedonistic lifestyle, angered the literary establishment of the time. Khasravi's critique of religion and culture was part of a mission to promote a form of deistic monotheism. He called his crusade for a rational religion, Pakdini, the pure religion, a path to counter what he considered the superstitious, worthless, and harmful teachings of established religions. It was a new creed to combat all the deviations that corrupted the pristine kernel of prophetic endeavours, deviations, he alleged, were introduced by deceitful and misguided followers of these religions. He denounced false myths, including Greek mythology, Christian and Muslim cults of saints, and any form of religious symbolism and ritual. His critique of Shi'ism, in particular, aimed at the ulama's demagogy. Generating deep antipathy among his Muslim opponents reflected a critical cleavage between the secularized and the traditional sectors of the society of his time. That flicker of antinomian rationalism, however, died out with Khasravi's assassination. Dissecting the arcane Islamic tradition, and especially Shi'i orthodoxy, also produced works of remarkable complexity and penetrating satire by Sadegh Hedayat, 1903-1950, arguably the greatest literary figure of 20th century Persian literature. He was operating in a sphere smaller even than Khasravi's, though perhaps with greater influence on the intellectual trends of the next generation. Born to a family of bureaucratic nobility of the Qajar period, Hedayat's French education and home tutoring provided him equal facility in European literature as in Persian high and folk cultures. Struggling with depression most of his life, which ended in his suicide in Paris, he was a pacifist by nature and a man of penetrating wit. As he was attracted during his residence in interwar France to the expressionist and surreal literature then in vogue, Kafka in particular left a lasting influence on him. He was equally well-versed in Persian culture, but critiqued it from a perspective very different from Khasravi's positivistic stance. Hedayat transformed his exposure to Western literature into a Persian setting both in substance and in style. Mostly writing short stories and novellas, his characters were set in the fast-disappearing world of an idealized past. His skeptical worldview and poignant soul-searching quest nevertheless kept Hedayat away from ideological indoctrination or prophetic visions. His Bouffe Court, Blind Owl, 1937, recognized as his literary masterpiece, is a surreal depiction of the author's fictional, multifaceted self and his complex interplay with many others. Here in the novel, Hedayat manifests himself in multiple characters. The reclusive opium addict who narrates the story imbues a sense of hopelessness and despair, and a lustful old man conveys the author's inner contempt for his cultural baggage, his class and family legacy, and political authority. Hedayat's idealized notions of love and his homosexual anxieties are portrayed by a two-sided female character who appears alternately as an ethereal woman and a promiscuous hag. They all reflect a preoccupation with decay and death, and yet they all seem to be fellow travelers in a mystical journey in search of something unattainable, an awareness of a layered inner world, a world of subjectivity. Unique in the context of Persian modern literature, and to a great degree indebted to the worldview in Khayyam's poems, this was the voice of a cultural outcast who defied the world of banal modernity built on a ramshackle of state authority. The title of the novel, Blind Owl, alludes to a popular Persian expression. The owl is a bird of ominous presence in Persian folk belief, implying a dazed onlooker who no longer can see through the darkness of the night. Written at the height of Reza Shah's absolute power, and while Hedayat was residing in India, where he studied the Pahlavi language with Parsis of Mumbai, the blind owl represented a dysfunctional member of the old elite who could not see a place for himself in the superficial world of Pahlavi modernity. A far less veiled criticism of religion and politics, of Iran's experience of modernity and its encounters with European hegemony, appears in Hedayat's 1949 Tupper Morvari, Canon of Good Omen, a piercing and profane satire of great intricacy with a loosely structured narrative reminiscent of James Joyce's Stream of Consciousness. Here, Islamic scripture, beliefs, and rituals, and those of other monotheistic religions, are mocked with singular insight. It is small wonder that the book, written under a pseudonym, was published only clandestinely more than 3 decades after its creation. In it, the institutions of Islam and the conduct of the clerical class, especially Shi'i clergy, Hedayat sees a legacy of cruelty, institutionalized violence, and obsessive ritualism. He also detected as much brute military force and blind Westernism in the follies of the Reza Shah era and the strictures imposed by that regime. Likewise, in European colonial expansion, characterized by a comical take on the 16th-century Portuguese maritime control of the Persian Gulf, he detected ruthless greed, aggression, and carnage. To this, he added a sarcastic critique of a culture of pettiness, fear, inferiority complex, pandering, animal cruelty, filth, and disease, despite the Shi'i obsession with scatological purification. This was a culture of decadence that he felt had accumulated over centuries, and was the origin of his own inescapable lot, an unending night of gloom. Hedayat's bitter sarcasm and fatalistic disdain for anything Islamic came with a nostalgic allure for the pre-Islamic past and pain over Iran's loss of its pristine language, culture, and identity to the Arab conquest of the 7th century, a sentiment he shared with Khasravi and a host of other Iranian intellectuals, poets, historians, and scholars of his time. His lifelong collecting and publishing of Iranian folklore and popular culture, studies in Middle Persian, Pahlavi texts, his historical plays on the tragic fall of the Sasanian Empire and crushing of the Iranian resistance movements by the Islamic Caliphate, all pointed to a cultural nationalism that sought glory in the past but denied renewal ahead. Hedayat's piercing skepticism aside, perhaps the most iconoclastic literary figure of the 1940s and 1950s was the poet Nima Yushija, 1896 to 1960. His break with the conventions of rhyme and classical meter, which had been observed for centuries and viewed as almost sacred by the Persian literary establishment, distinguished him as a literary revolutionary. His poetic themes, moreover, were not free of expressions of romantic despair, inspired by the pastoral motifs of his Mozandaran homeland, experiences of his solitary life, and his deep feeling for society's ills. Informed as much by the modern French poetry of his time as by his Tudeh affinity, these were equally important for Nima's endurance as a literary icon. Born to a landowning family from Yush in the Nur region, 160 miles north of Tehran, he was brought up in the country before receiving a French education in a missionary school in Tehran, an education he shared with his friend Hedayat. The literary war over the new poetry, Sher-e No, waged for decades in the press, literary circles, and academia, had a subtext of political orientation. Nima's poetry reflected the simplicity of pastoral life and its pristine beauty, but also a social mission to give voice to suffering, hardship, and political suffocation. His famous 1948 ode, Mahtab, Moonlight, composed at the height of his political involvement, reflected the poet's failing hopes for a mass awakening, while a faint desire for a dawn or renewal is still alive. The moonlight gleams, the glowworm glows, not a moment of broken sleep in anyone's eyes. Yet, agony over this slumbering lot shatters sleep from my tearful eyes. Anxious beside me stands the dawn. Morning urges me to break the news of its blessed breath to this soulless lot. I wring my hands in worry to open a door. I wait in vain for one to come to the door. But their derelict windows and walls crumble on my head. Tired, with blistered feet from a long journey, before the village gate stands a lonesome man. His bundle on his back, his hand on the knocker, he whispers to himself, "Agony over this slumbering lot shatters sleep from my tearful eyes." The glowworm in Moonlight no doubt symbolizes the poet in a liminal environment of insecurity and doubt. His faint, throbbing light, promising the daybreak, is set against the indifference of the slumbering village who closed its doors on him and his message. Tired and tearful, he is about to be crushed under the caving of a derelict house, which no doubt is an allusion to the legacy of his country's past. Another poet of the younger generation, Mahdi Akhavan Sales, 1928 to 1990, expressed similar sentiments. He lamented not only the demise of the national movement and the return of Pahlavi coercion, but also the futility of the experience of the left and the ideological betrayal it sustained. Akhavan, better known by his pen name Amid, meaning hope, resorted to the memories of Iran's pre-Islamic past, the purity of the Zoroastrian religion, and the egalitarian memory of Mazdakism to highlight the grim decay of his own time. Born in Mashhad and proud of the literary heritage of Khorasan, Akhavan remained loyal more than any other modernist poet to classical masters. He rendered a subtle mix of classical and modern with a powerful message of cultural nationalism, an undertone of social commitment, and, predictably, a sense of defiant despair. The last theme is evident in his 1956 masterpiece, Kaveh Yor Eskandar, Kaveh or Alexander, composed while in prison on charges of pro-Tudeh activism. It portrays the suffocating calm that pervaded the aftermath of the 1953 coup. Conveying a message of betrayed hopes and futile resistance, he skillfully uses Persian expressions, proverbs, and allegories to break from artistic isolation and speak with ordinary folks. The waves have calmed, quiet and subdued. The drum of the storm has fallen silent. Springs of smouldering flames have now dried up. All the waters have run their course. In the tombstone land of this pulseless city, not even the call of an owl can be heard. The gallows were removed, the blood washed away, in place of flowers of agony, fury, and revolt. Now the evil weeds have taken their sprawling root. It is night here, indeed, a nightmarish dark. Yet beyond the hill there was no daylight either. Whoever came over grabbed his loot and moved on. Again, miserable, humiliated, and deprived, we remained. Of that, what did we reap but lies and lies? Of this, what did we reap but deceit and deceit? Then again, they say, another day, wait for another to come. No, Cavaix will ever be found, O Amid. I wish an Alexander would be found. The powerful ending, lamenting the absence of Cavaix, the ironsmith revolutionary of the Shahnameh legend, who rose against the tyrant Zahag, is most likely a reference to Mossadegh and an unlikely future struggle against the regime. Amid's shattered hopes could seek only the return of an alien Alexander, the arch-villain of Zoroastrian memory who destroyed the ancient Persian Empire. In his 1957 Akhere Shahnameh, meaning Shahnameh's ending, alluding to the ironic Persian proverb, Shahnameh has a happy ending, he further contrasts the dream of the epic past, wiped out by Alexander, here no doubt an allegory for the damning forces of the West, with the sad fate of his own country, depreciated and decayed. This out-of-tune, broken harp, tamed in the hand of that frenzied old bard, as if at times it dreams, sees itself in the glittering presence of the sun, that unique vista of the happy countenance of Zarathustra. Here the poet wishfully imagines his nation, confident and righteous, challenging the hegemonic demons and conquering their arrogant land of nothingness. We, conquerors of castles of historical pride, witnesses to glorious cities of every era, we, memorials to forlorn innocence of epochs past, narrators of sweet and happy tales. Yet the reality of his people is tragically different from the impossible dreams of the poet's harp. The new tune is nothing but the tragic lament at the end of the legendary part of the Shahnameh, where Rostam, son of Dastan, the greatest of the Shahnameh's heroes, is dying at the bottom of a pit, having been set up by no less an enemy than his own traitorous half-brother. The poet plays on the tragedy of two Rostams. The other is Rostam, the son of Farrukhzad, the commander-in-chief of the Sasanian army. His defeat and capture in the Battle of Gadesiyeh in 636 at the hands of the invading Arab armies brings the narrative of the Shahnameh to its tragic end. The poet, rebuking his broken harp, comes to his mournful finale, a famous passage in modern Persian poetry. O, you miserable babbler, change your tune. Never again will the son of Dastan emerge from his half-brother's pit. Died, died, he died. Now recite the story of the son of Farrukhzad, one whose laments come as if from the depth of a yawning well. He cries and laments and says, alas, we now appear like hunchbacked old conquerors aboard ships of waves with sails of foam, hearts set on glorious lambs grazing in fields of hollow times, our blades rusty, ancient and blunt, our drums eternally silent, our arrows broken-winged. We, conquerors of cities gone with the wind, with a voice so faint it can never escape our lungs, narrators of long-forgotten tales. Not a soul will take our coins for anything, even an old penny, as if they're an alien king's or a prince's whose dynasty has vanished long ago. From time to time we wake from this charmed slumber, like that deep sleep of the companions of the cave. Rubbing our eyes, we cry, behold, that unique golden castle of sweet morning light. But alas, the tyrant never dies. Here the tyrant, the Dagyanus of the Islamic legend, who claimed to be divine, evidently based on the 3rd century Roman emperor Decius, reigned 249 to 251, and the persecution of early Christians, probably is an allusion to Reza Shah. The 7 companions of the cave, Ashab-e Kaffa, who feared Dagyanus' persecution, took refuge in a cave and fell into a deep sleep, from which they awoke centuries later, however, makes reference to the fate of the Iranian people. Fearing their tyrannical rulers, they too fell into a deep sleep, from which they awakened to a brief moment of hope, which was only to be followed by another cycle of tyranny. The poet's last assertion, but alas, the tyrant never dies, has an ominous ring, given what would come to pass in the quarter century after the poem's composition. Against a background of shattered hopes, a yearning for a rebirth, a nostalgic longing for a world of natural purity, began to emerge in the poetry of Farrukh Farrukhzad, 1935 to 1967. A poet of tormented love and sensibilities, she explored a feminine self, keenly aware of her social surroundings. Born in Tehran to a middle-class military family, Farrukh questioned religious conventions, sexual stigma, and patriarchal tyranny. Gender awareness is evident in her earlier collections, but it is in her Tavaladi Digar, A Rebirth, from 1964, that she transcended to a new plane of almost mystical awareness, achieved after a journey of self-discovery. As a critic of women's marginality, religious dogma, and social deprivation, Farrukh has already reacted to the clerical establishment that stigmatized her as rebellious and profane. By questioning, in the fashion of Khayyam, the very notions of divinity and religious faith, in her Bandegi, Servitude, a long poem in the form of dialogue with the Creator, composed circa 1956 in the genre of Sufi monologues and dream narratives, she states, "On my lips a shadow of a mysterious question, in my heart a pain, restless and burning my soul. The secret of this rebellious, wandering spirit I now wish to share with you. Does my lament ever reach you, so that you may crush your cup of self-adoration, and sit with me, the earthy one, for a moment, and drink the pain of existence from the lips of my poetry?" This existential questioning brings Farrukh to an agnostic portrayal of a god who is tyrannical, self-engrossed, and exploitative, an unusually candid expression for poets of the period, most of whom were engaged with earthly rather than with divine tyranny. She goes on, "You cast a shadow upon the end, and in your hand a rope on the other end of which were necks, dragging people on the pathway of life, their eyes bedazzled by the image of the hereafter. So long as we, the wretched ones, call you just, you cover your countenance in a silky mask of compassion, and turn paradise into a mysterious myth, offering it as credit in exchange for the cash of people's lives." Farrukh's personal soul-searching later increasingly turned into social themes. In her poem E Marze Por Gohar, O Bejeweled Fatherland, a parody published in 1963 on the title of Iran's banned national anthem, she sneers at clichés of Pahlavi patriotism and bureaucratic fixing of individual identities. She mocks bogus surroundings suffused with jingoism, a culture of sycophancy, cheap ambitions, the even cheaper material culture of Western imports, and, of course, imperial vainglory. "I am victorious. I managed to register myself. I managed to adorn myself with a name on an identity card, and my existence is now marked by a number. So long live 678, issued in District 5, resident of Tehran. Now I can rest assured that everything is in order, the bosom of the caring motherland, the pacifier of prideful historical heritage, the lullaby of civilization and culture, and the rattling of the rattles of the law. Now I can rest assured that everything is in order. So elated was I that I rushed to the window and with ecstasy inhaled down into my lungs 678 times the air infused with dung and dust and the odor of trash and urine, and signed at the bottom of 678 IOUs and wrote atop 678 job applications Farrukh Farrukhzad. In the land of poetry, of the flower and nightingale, living is a blessing, particularly when after many, many years your existence is acknowledged. I have come to existence among such productive masses who, despite having no bread to eat, have an open and far-reaching field of vision, with geographical boundaries that currently span in the north to the lush and sweet-smelling firing range, in the south to the ancient gallows square, and in the heavily populated areas reach the artillery square. I am victorious. Yes, I am victorious. Long live 678, issued in District 5, resident of Tehran, who, relying on her perseverance and resolve, has reached such a high station that she stood on the frame of her window, that is 678 metres above the ground, and has the great honour, from that very opening, not through the staircase, of throwing herself, madly, headlong onto the lap of the caring motherland. And her last wish would be that for a gift of 678 gold coins, His Excellency the Poet Laureate Abraham Saba would, as a tribute to her life, conjure a mournful ode rhyming with gobbledygook. That in her last poems, published posthumously in 1973, she finds a messianic vision not unlike that of other members of her literary cohort, is a corollary to the bleak humour of the previously mentioned poem. A revolutionary upheaval comes to transform her unlivable surroundings. In her poem, Kasi Mesle Hichkas Nist, The One Who Is Not Like Anyone Else, the poet sees a revolutionary future through the eyes of a working-class child from the poor neighbourhoods of southern Tehran. I dreamed that someone is coming. I dreamed of a red star. Someone who can do something so spectacular that the Allah neon lamp that was green, green like the light of the dawn, will be lit up again over the neighbourhood mosque. He who is with us in his heart, with us in his breath, with us in his voice, he whose coming cannot be arrested, handcuffed and thrown into jail, the one who comes down from the sky of Artillery Square in a night of fireworks, who spreads the tablecloth and divides up the bread, and divides up the Pepsi, and divides up the public park, and divides up the whooping cough syrup, and divides up school registration day, and divides up the hospital waiting numbers, and divides up the rubber boots, and divides up the Fardeen movies, and divides up the clothing of Sayyid Javad's daughter, and divides up every unsold jumble, and gives us our share too. I had a dream. The ending especially is remarkable, coming in the aftermath of the June 1963 uprising, and containing tantalizing allusions to a socialist revolution with clear Islamic undertones. That the poet of Joyful Sin, whose poems once were publicly denounced on the pulpit, was now dreaming the descent of a saviour, was a telling example of how the mystique of a forthcoming revolution began to take root among the intellectuals of the period. Ahmad Shamlou, 1925-2000, also the son of a military officer, perhaps was the most avant-garde in his coining of complex poetic imagery and rich symbolic language. He, too, engaged with melancholic disillusionments and delved into the discourse of messianic aspirations, but with the image of a saviour who preached not only a worldly reality devoid of hereafter, but also peace and non-violence. In his 1965 Loha, The Tablet, inspired by the imagery of the Hebrew Bible and the narrative of the Gospels, his Messiah, no doubt the poet himself, brings a clay tablet with a message of compassion to a public as incredulous and inattentive as those in Nima's Mahtab. Then I raised the clay tablet to the end of my arm and cried out to the crowd, "Whatever all there is this, and beyond there is nothing else. It's an old tablet, worn out, this here. Behold. Though soiled with filth and the blood of many wounds, it speaks of compassion, friendship, and purity." But people's ears and hearts were not with me, as if from expectation, one could surmise, they got profit and pleasure. I shouted, "If you were true to yourself, you'd know that you're waiting in vain. The last message is all here." I cried out, "The time of lamenting your crucified Messiah has passed. For now every woman is Mary, and every Mary has Jesus on the cross, with no crown of thorns, cross, or Golgotha, without Pilate, judges, or trial. Messiahs all of a common destiny, identical messiahs, in identical uniforms, with identical boots and gaiters, all the same and equal rations of bread and broth. Yes, equality is the precious heritage of mankind. And if there is no crown of thorns, there is a helmet to put on, and if no cross to carry on the shoulder, there is a rifle. The means of greatness now is all ready. And every supper may very well be the last supper, and every gaze the gaze of a Judas. But don't waste time to find a garden, for you will encounter the tree on the cross, when the dream of humanity and compassion, like a fog, soft and light-footed, will dissipate. And, alas, The path of the cross is no longer the path of ascent to heaven, but a path toward hell and eternal wandering of the soul. I was crying out in the depth of my fever, but people's ears and hearts were not with me. I knew they were awaiting not a clay tablet, but a book and a sword. Alas, these people seek the truth only in legends, or else know the truth as nothing but legend. And my fire did not alight within them, for I had spoken the last word about heaven without ever bringing heaven to my tongue. Shamlou's last word about heaven and on the messianic return was a fitting end to the post-war antinomian discourse. His counter-messianic hero aimed for a faith akin to the Iranian experience. Yet the message of this humanist messiah, as the poet laments, was bound to be rejected by a public enamoured of militarism, war, and violence. These, too, were experiences known to the people of his generation. The elaborate imagery and complex message of the new poetry, masterful and penetrating though they were, hardly ever reached beyond an intellectual elite, as Shamlou's poem admits. Ironically, much of this gloom in the poetry of the period was expressed at a time when Iran of the 1960s experienced tangible material progress, relative prosperity among the secular middle classes, and a level of general stability. Perhaps this was also the best decade of the 20th century in terms of artistic ingenuity and poetic symbolism, even though the poets and intellectuals of the period were essentially at odds with the Pahlavi regime. This was a respite for them to pause and ponder the naive idealism of earlier years and come up with a reflective reading of themselves, their society, and the baggage of their past. Though, with hindsight, they were removed from the harsh realities of their time, there was something remarkably novel in their production. Perhaps, despite their wishes, their anguished vision paved the way for an alternative route to authenticity, a discourse with far-reaching consequences, and, ironically, a very different kind of revolution.